We're actually working on a location in China right now. We've come really close to Australia. We've come close to Canada, Dubai, Great Britain. We've had partners that, you know, wanted to do all of Mexico or all of South America. And at the end of the day, we just couldn't confirm whether or not they were just laundering money. So we didn't go with it. Just the way we do business. We're very careful in anything and everything we do. But eventually we will be in foreign markets. It's just a matter of time and finding the right partners.
I'm Paul Olson. I'm the host of The Future of Pickleball. We're here being broadcast on Selkirk TV. You can see this show on the Selkirk TV app, or you can catch it on YouTube. Today, we've got a guest that's a return guest. He's got some great history going on in pickleball. Let's welcome Will Richards to the show. How are you doing, Will?
I'm great, Paul. How are you today?
Good. Good. Will is the co-founder and developer of the Dill Dinkers franchise organization that has been very successful in pickleball. He was on the show just about a year ago when we were sort of talking about where things were going to go through the end of 2024 and into 2025. And today I want to talk to Will about how the progress is going, what's happening in the sport. For our guests that didn't see the first episode, Will, why don't you give us just a little bit of an idea as to what Dill Dinkers is doing, how you're rolling, and I'd like to cover the actual timeline of when you got started.
So we got started about 3 years ago. We opened our first facility about 2.5 years ago. And we decided to franchise within a couple of months of opening because we came out of the gate really strong. We started franchising about 4 months, 5 months after our first opening. And since then, we've sold somewhere between 450 and 500 units that are on development schedules. Yesterday morning, we actually opened our number 18 store in San Antonio.
Perfect.
We have three more scheduled to open in the next 6 weeks. And we have our first acquisition. I can't tell you who, but it was an independent facility that wanted to switch over to become a Dill Dinkers. So that's in the process of happening right now. And we're getting a lot of interest from independents that want to switch over to our model.
Very nice. Very nice. One of the things that I want to mention and or actually get you to just expand on a little bit is the idea of opening your first site and then within months deciding to do franchising. Tell the viewers a little bit about what your personal background has been in franchising prior to the Dill Dinkers.
So I worked for Domino's Pizza through the late 80s and the early 90s. And I actually franchised with Domino's. I had seven locations. That's so that's where my bug for franchising came from.
Sure. Yeah, and that makes sense. What I'd like to do before I start getting into the specific questions about what's different today than was a year ago or 2 years ago, why don't you just cover briefly what is the Dill Dinkers model in the franchising world and what is your sweet spot in that business?
So our model is different than other folks in the space. We have a regional developer model where we sell territories, and then people have the ability to sell franchises in their territory and create like mini franchisor situations. So we have an RD now that has two locations up and running under their umbrella. We have one that has three, and soon we're going to have one that has four. So it's just a way to grow very quickly as opposed to trying to do one at a time. Because when you buy a franchise territory that's a small area, you have a smaller area to look for a potential location. When you buy a whole territory, you have a bigger swath of geography to actually find something that makes sense.
Very nice. You know, I remember when we did the last interview and we had you and Ben Letalian on together, one of the subjects that came up that you said was really sort of a very key element that you guys were focusing on was the lease, the kind of the terms of the lease, the deal that went together there. Touch on that a little bit and specifically think in terms of has there been any change in the marketplace from a year ago when we had our first conversation about this to today?
Oh, absolutely. You've probably heard about like Big Lots going out of business and a myriad of other commercial things that have all of a sudden become open. It's mainly retail, big box. So what we found is landlords are charging more. There's a lot of interest in these big box spaces. And the landlords they're not budging. They want the same type of rates that they were getting from the previous people that were renting those spaces. So it is possible to find good retail leases, but it's more difficult than, say, light industrial or mixed use stuff. So what we've decided to do is we make sure that the leases come into a certain dollar amount, and we compare that to the demographics, we compare that to drive times, and we make sure that the franchisees aren't signing something that they're going to regret. Because all business is a risk, it's all a big roll of the dice, but you want to give yourself as much runway as possible for success. And that starts off with a lease that makes sense.
Yeah, very nice. Now, there had been some topic or some discussion about the fact that you either were or were going to begin looking into a ground up, from the ground up properties. Has that manifested itself at all with Dildinkers?
Some of our regional developers are looking for that, but we haven't actually got one started yet. You know, in many cases, when you're trying to establish a market, you don't necessarily want to spend 2 years building something initially. You want to get into the market, get something leased, and you want to get open. And like phase two is finding the land and doing more of the McDonald's model, which is more of a real estate play versus a pickleball play. So most of our regional developers know that phase two is going to be that. Because in many cases, you're going into facilities that aren't ideal for pickleball. And you'd much rather build it from the ground up so that you hit all the boxes for that super premium experience. Now, there's a lot of locations that we turn down because they are so out of whack. It's like an efficiency standard that we use internally. And if the building doesn't hit the efficiency standard when you compare that to the pro forma, then we don't allow the franchisees to pursue it. And that's probably one of the reasons why our growth has not been as robust as what we anticipated, because we've sold a lot of franchises. But we're very particular where people open them. To give you an example, somebody reached out on our franchise hotline, if you will. They have a 13-court facility that's been open for 3 months, and they want to get out. Okay, so we ran the demographics. We would have never have allowed anybody to open that. There's just not enough people there to fill 13 courts. And that's part of what we're running into with a lot of the independents that are struggling. They made fundamental issues got created from day one. Like they didn't even realize they were going to be underwater in 6 months because you don't know what you don't know. So we help people make those good decisions and we like to right-size the number of courts to the demographics. You just can't build a huge facility in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't really matter how cheap it is because you just won't be able to fill all those courts. So, you know, where that 13-court facility is, it could probably be successful with a 5 or 6-court facility. You got to right-size your building for the demographics.
You know, and that is something that I've enjoyed the opportunity to meet with and interview the 4 major CEOs, including yourself, and the idea of how a new business operator in a new industry decides to navigate the space. The franchise thing just seems to make absolute sense to me for exactly the reasons you're describing. Now, one of the things that I did want to kind of get an update from you on, has there been any changes in your perceptions of the market or the perceptions of the sport of pickleball in the last year that have caused any kind of adjustments or changes in the way you're operating your business or your franchises?
I would say the main thing is, well, there's a couple things that we've done in the last year. One is streamlining our pro shop operations by having a partnership with Pickleball Central. That has been very instrumental in streamlining our operations because, Paul, you and I have talked about reducing friction in business, and that's one of our number one things that we try to do. So, you know, did we give up some revenue? Yes. But to allow the players to have access to 20 or 30 brands of paddle versus just one was huge because it's all about the traffic and who's coming into play. And Pickleball Central has been a big part of that. The other thing is what I just mentioned was the right sizing of facilities. If I was this, you know, probably in the last 6 months, we've had about 20 places reach out to us and say, can you please help us? One of the main problems people have is they have their facilities are too big. They're just paying a lot of rent in a building that, you know, consistently could probably fill 6 courts, but they're trying to fill 12. And when you start running into more and more competition, mm-hmm. which is really happening now, you know, we started out in Maryland with one indoor pickleball place, which was Dildinkers. And now between Dildinkers and our competitors, there's 11. So you have to be cognizant mm-hmm. of, oh, maybe you can fill 12 courts now, but when you have 3 competitors within 20 minutes, are you going to be able to consistently fill 12 courts? You possibly could, but that's when the competition is really getting hot and heavy, and people are just going to go, we feel like, to the closest place. If everything is apples to apples as far as service and community, et cetera, people are going to start to look for saving time on their trip to play pickleball. When we first opened our first location, we had people coming from an hour to come play. Now those same people are going to their local Dildinkers. And that was part of our whole plan, was to saturate a market with facilities that are 20 minutes apart. And we're really beginning to see the benefits of mm-hmm. that. Our national network membership is now active. So when I was at the opening of our facility in Hilton Head, I saw people from Maryland coming in to play because they were there on vacation. It was the same way with Sarasota, and it'll be that way in all the markets as the, we call it cross-pollination. Our members start to go to the different facilities, and we have a couple of LOIs signed in Las Vegas now, so I'm sure that's going to be a really big draw for players around the country, for Dildinkers to play in their facility in Las Vegas.
Yeah. You know, you're really kind of hitting on a lot of the stuff that I was hoping to cover today. One of the things that I've found very interesting, I think in a conversation, I don't remember whether I had it with you or with one of the other franchise operators, but they spoke in depth about the franchise development document, the FDD. Tell me a little bit about how that works and how you guys use it specifically in telling your story.
So the FDD is a document that you have to be given if you're going down the road of franchising. You're given the document. It gives you all the data you need to know about the franchise. There's certain things that we have to put in there. There's other things that are optional. So for our FDD that we updated last year, we chose to put a full P&L from a Dildinkers in our document so people can see, you know, what are the possibilities here? Now, that P&L wasn't as accurate as it could be because it was a new location, open for a year. So that looks different if when it's more mature after, say, 2 years. So it's important to look at the FTD to see the most up-to-date information that the franchisor puts in their FDD. So everybody has an FDD. They're out there. You can look at them. And it helps you make a decision, which one of these entities are you going to go with? We like it when people look at all of the entities and make a final decision, because we feel like from a value perspective, we're probably number one as far as the ultimate value you get when you open a facility, because our average facility cost is between $400,000 and $500,000. A lot of our competitors, it's well over $1 million. So, and in the end of the day, you get the same result or better with a Dildinkers, having not spent so much money up front, because we found that a lot of the bells and whistles, the players really don't care about. They just want a good playing experience. They want to develop their community, and they want a place where they can consistently count on getting court time with their membership.
Now, as we go along on exactly that subject, when we talk about the difference between a first year and second year on the FDD, what are you seeing in terms of what the growth cycle or the plateauing, what happens between the fresh first year and then going into the second year? And as the sport continues to grow, is there a pattern that you see coming out in that?
There are patterns, and a lot of them are driven by what time of the year that you open and where are you located at. The Florida market is different than the Northeast, which is different than Texas. And we try to help our franchisees navigate that. We recently had a franchisee opening in the Northeast, and they were supposed to open in November, but because of all kinds of delays, they didn't get open until April. And April, May, June is the toughest time for indoor pickleball. So we were able to go with the franchisee to their landlord and say, look, this is not going to be a full facility when we open. It's going to take a while to ramp up because everybody's playing outside because they've been cooped up indoors all winter long. So the landlord was able to give them 3 months of free rent, and that gets them through that time when it's very hard to fill courts, more closer to the time when it's either really hot or the winter weather starts to kick in the fall. So a lot of these, you know, Arizona is definitely different than the Northeast. So part of our franchise experiment, if you will, is figuring out what works in all these different markets and gathering up as much intel to support the franchisee as possible.
You know, you're arriving at something that I'm now beginning to see in the marketplace. I live in the Arizona market. You know, it's a very vibrant pickleball scene. We've got a lot going on here. I'm beginning to see where brand building amongst the franchise organizations seem to be coming a factor. And I wanted to ask you some questions. As you develop the Dildinkers brand, does that also help with not only the consumer, but also with the lease negotiations? I think back in the day when the discussion with franchises was always location, 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 because the franchise had to be put someplace where there was guaranteed traffic. Does the Dildinkers brand factor both ways?
Oh, yeah. Our first location is on the backside of a warehouse. It has no visibility whatsoever, but it's totally maxed out. I mean, we have to build another facility to take care of the overflow. When you go into a retail situation, you get some of that visibility up front, but you pay for it. Your price per square foot is definitely more. Finding locations is definitely the hardest thing, and finding the right location. But there's ways that you can mitigate that decision-making process by just doing your homework on the location. There's so many war stories out there of just putting a spot in the wrong place. Like, you can have a really cheap rent, but if you're 15 miles outside of town and somebody opens up in the middle of town, they're going there. That's all there is to it. Unless what you have is so attractive that people are going to spend an extra 20 minutes to drive to you. And you figure if they're playing three times a week, 20 times three, the trip there, the trip back, time is important to people. It's valuable. And if they can get the same thing going 10 minutes versus 30 minutes, they're going to do that. They're going to go the 10 minutes.
Sure. And that makes sense. You know, one of the things that I have heard a lot of discussions, we talked about it a little bit on the first interview that we did, was how programming factors into club utilization and club success. Is that still pretty much the same standard we talked about a year ago? Has anything evolved or changed there? Or are there any new ideas coming into the game?
If anything, our approach is being reinforced week in and week out. We grow our own player base as well as cater to the existing players in an area. We try to make sure that our programming is not so focused on one group of players that the others are kind of blocked out of playing. We've been introducing 24/7 access to our facilities, which has been a big help to take some of the pressure off on the peak times, because most people want to play after 4 o'clock, not after 9 o'clock. So you have your courts that are like completely full then. So you have to get really creative as far as programming to bring them in the other parts of the day. And then different levels of player like to play different times of the day as well. Like a lot of the higher level players are playing at night. Which pushes out the intermediate and the low-level players, which is literally your bread and butter. 10% of the mm-hmm. player base is 4.0 and above. So if you're just catering to that, you're not going to have enough utilization of your courts to make it. So you have to be able to cater to everybody, from very small children just getting started to older adults that like to play in a more calm, relaxing atmosphere. Well, most of them anyway. So you just got to figure out the best way for your programming to hit all those levers so that you're fully utilizing your player base.
I want to take a quick moment to tell you about something new in pickleball. We have all been ghosted in the pickleball group chat. Now here's a way to fix that. Get the Play More Pickleball app. We're trying to get some pickleball in, so you send out a message to the group. A few people like the message, but what does that mean? Will they actually show up? And what kind of players are they? Will you have enough people for doubles? Playmore is the new pickleball app that does the frustrating part for you. It will send smart invitations to play. You can easily see who's RSVP'd, and then you can use the AI matchmaking tool to balance your games. That means no more 5-0 versus 3-0 matchups. The best part, it's free. Find it in the App Store or use the web version at getplaymore.com. Playmore is the most stress-free scheduling app in pickleball. Now, let's get back to the show. You've said something that I remember you saying earlier to me is the idea that you are growing your own customer base. This is something that I've thought was going to be very critical as franchising matures. Is it's real nice to look and say, can the local market fill my facility to capacity? Probably not a real common thing. I love the fact that now every one of the business operators coming into the game starts to realize it's their responsibility for their own success to grow more players and introduce more people to the game. I love that idea of helping contribute to the growth of the game. When you guys look at that, you mentioned the 24/7 access. On a percentage basis, in your really off hours, after 9 o'clock at night, let's say before 7 o'clock in the morning, How much, what is a percentage use that they're getting of 24/7 access?
It's probably less than 5%. But the nature of it, it's not a big number, but it's a number that goes right to the bottom line because you're not staffing it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the concept of just having a 24/7 facility, I think it can work if the lease is cheap enough, because you're never going to have the volume of a facility that's manned because you're not establishing community. You can't have as many programming options. I mean, people like to go play pickleball to socialize, not necessarily to have a full meal or drink a beer. You know, Paul, you're aware we don't do that. Our franchisees can do it if they want to, but nobody has chosen that path because we feel like that lane in pickleball, if you will, has already got enough people in it. And to jump into, you know, we were at Pickle and Electric Pickle in Arizona a couple weeks ago, and the courts were all full. The people that were playing were drinking water. And the restaurant, I think we were like the only people in there. So when we look at that situation, there are markets for that. It can be a success, but it's just not the way we're going to do it. We like small footprints, facilities that are easier to fill, to build that sense of community, and just build more of them. It's almost like we're the fast food of pickleball. But we internally speak about ourselves as the Chick-fil-A of pickleball. It may be fast food, but it's the best you can get with the best service.
And on that order, where we're talking about this in the different kinds of models or the different clubs, what would be the case study? Which club or which location would be the case study that you would showcase has been the greatest success in the Del Dinkers history?
Wow, that's a good question. We have some facilities out there, some of the newer ones. Like, it's funny, when you go to Columbia, it was our first one. I did a lot of the work there. I was going around on the big reach and hitting my head on the ceiling, all kinds of crazy stuff. And we haven't remodeled it yet. It still has that first look about it. When you look at our most recent openings, like Chantilly, Virginia, it's beautiful. It is so much aesthetically pleasing than, say, Columbia. But our Columbia facility is doing gangbusters, which is part of the reasons why when we look at a situation, we're like, you don't need to have a $1.5 million facility. You can do just as well with something that was a lot more cheap to build. We have a facility in Connecticut. I can't go into all the numbers because of FCC rules, but I can say it blows us away. It's all about the owner operators and what they do, the community, the programming. And we do some programming that nobody else does. It's not like, you know, top secret. People can figure it out. But the way we do things, it's phenomenal. We probably have, out of the 18 clubs, I would say 10 of them are really surprising how well they do. Then you have, you know, in any type of situation, you have the top, the middle, and the bottom. But the ones that are at the bottom, we understand why they're struggling. And we're fixing it, and we're doing things to enhance the marketing, et cetera, because this whole industry is so new, Paul. I mean, really, indoor pickleball places started popping up 4 or 5 years ago, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned. There's mistakes to be made, and one of the reasons, you know, franchising isn't for everybody. We had a gentleman that we talked to for about 6 months about becoming a Del Dinkers franchise. Last minute, he decided to go off on his own. Fast forward 6 months later, we signed a lease a couple miles away from him. And he's calling us up saying, I don't know, I can't figure out how to make this work. And now you're down the street. Can you buy my facility? There's no silver bullet for success in this, but having a franchise keeps you away from a lot of those pitfalls and major mistakes that can sink you even before you get started. Now, that being said, there's independents out there that just do fantastic. So the royalties that you pay, you get a return on. But if you can make it work without royalties, you know, more power to you. Our first one, we did it on our own, and it turned out okay. But there, like I said, there's just a lot of huge mistakes that are being made. People are signing personal guarantees on 10-year leases. It's scary out there. I still remember, I think I told you the story, the first time I signed our first lease, you know, I'm just an average government contractor kind of guy, just middle class, doing okay. And I'm signing a $20,000 a month lease. And my hands were just shaking. I'm like, this is the first one. It better work. And, you know, part of it too, Paul, is... Part of it too is we're willing to help people. Like the facility that we're turning into a Dildinkers here in the next couple of weeks. These folks were on the verge of going out of business. Like they were, I wouldn't say they were desperate, but they were really looking for answers. And you know me, Paul, I'm always talking and shaking hands and meeting people. And it was one of those people that I met along the way. And she was like, can you help? So we did some things. We waived our initial franchise fee because they have to rebrand. We're going to dedicate some resources to getting them turned around and getting them up and running in a more positive fashion. And we're going to be announcing in the next couple of months a program that's going to be available for people that are struggling that think that, you know, we could help. We're going to announce it. We're going to say, this is the program we're putting in place. And, you know, the biggest part of that is waiving the franchise fee because it's $50,000. But we waive it because if somebody comes to you for help, the last thing they need is to get hit with a $50,000 franchise fee. Plus the rebranding, repainting the courts, et cetera, et cetera. So we go out of our way to help them because, you know, you and I have talked about this and me and Dave. Pickleball needs to be successful from an indoor perspective. And if we have too many places that aren't making it,
yep,
it's not good. So whatever we can do to help, we're willing to do that. Now we can't pay your bills and do this, that, and the other, but the expertise that we bring to the table could be the difference between you going bankrupt or having a healthy business.
Well, and the thing, I think back to my lifetime in the business world, I loved, and I always looked for case studies of ideas of either new concepts or new product development or things in that order, that case studies can be a great example. And that's what I'm expecting we're going to have happen in franchising, is the standpoint that there are different approaches, different ways that different companies address the complexity of what pickleball is from the business side of things. But at the end of the day, I've got to believe in an 75 or 80% of the markets in the United States, there becomes a business formula that is really leads towards success. And that's my perspective, and I'm not a franchise guy. Do you think I'm right, or do you think we're on that track?
Yeah, you're definitely right. Now, one of the things we did when we started franchising, we had 5 corporate units that we opened first. And each one of those corporate units was like a mini experiment as to how is this going to work. We put a large facility in the middle of nowhere thinking people would drive 45 minutes. Well, they're not. So we're not going to allow anybody to do that. Now, that location it's doing okay, but it's not doing gangbusters. And we tell people that at our discovery day. Like, we will not allow you to build this sort of facility. We have a situation where we built 2 facilities within 6 miles of each other at the same time, because the demographics showed that there's that many pickleball players there, you can probably be okay. Well, what we found out was we got two filling up at the same time over the course of a year, as opposed to one filling up and then open the second one and then it fills up. So what you do is you put yourself in a situation where you're losing money at two locations for a longer extended period of time. So all these little experiments that we did is how we, and it's kind of like what you said, they're like case studies. It's like, what is it? What is that proven formula at the end of the day that makes the most sense? And what we found was with our first location, that was the proven formula. So as we move forward with new franchisees, we funnel them to that that scenario as much as possible, because we know that's the return you're going to get from this location. Now, the other locations have all done well over time or broke even, the one. But we just felt it was really important to figure out what works and what doesn't work. Because when you're franchising, you have to sell people the thing that works. Like if you're selling franchises, but you haven't even opened a location, for the life of me, I can't figure out who would buy that. But it happens. So our number one concern is the health of our franchisees and setting them up for success.
Yeah. And I love that idea. I think of all of the small and independent businesses that I worked with in my working life in the sporting goods industry, it really was, you were measured on one hand by your successes, but you also were measured on your failures. And so the fewer failures we can have in this sport, I think really contribute to the long-term growth of it. We've kind of talked about this thing and brought it up to date. Guide me a little bit, is where do you think you're going to be at the end of 2025 with facilities up and operating, open and doing business?
We should be somewhere between 30 and 40 units. It kind of depends on how many.
Very nice.
The independents that we kind of transition over. Without any of that, we'll be at least 30 open. When you asked me that question last year, I had a much more lofty number in mind, but it is difficult to open these things. There's all kinds of last minute permitting of this and getting this done. Like our San Antonio location was supposed to open a month ago. And when they came to do the final inspections, something happened with the electrician and something didn't pass. So we had to wait another month. And when I talked to the other guys, you know, we're all going through the same thing. So most people aren't emphasizing now how many units they've sold and how many units are on a development schedule, because everybody's behind. It is so much harder. And the funny thing is, when we first started, we opened 4 in 10 months. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be easy. Nope. As soon as we start getting into some of these other states and all their different rules and regulations, it just ground to a halt. Our average RD is probably opening 1 or 2 a year at best. And it's not about financial restrictions. It's about locations.
So, Will, we've been having a great opportunity to get updated on where things have been over the last year with Dilldinkers. As we start to look out into 2025, as we start to look out into 2026 and 2027, with what you're learning about the marketplace, how you're finding your new franchisees, what would you project you think is going to happen in terms of locations opening and new businesses starting in pickleball?
I think it's going to continue on its current trajectory for ourselves. You know, if we wind up between 30 and 40 at the end of this year, we're looking at the end of next year to be between 50 and 100. Just because of the way we're signing leases, we have our ground game working full time, our FBCs out there. So from our perspective, that's what it looks like for us. Plus we're starting another company, which is more of a data, community centric, company. Which we've had a round of funding, and we're getting ready to start a second round of funding. It actually started this week, and we should be announcing that in the next couple of weeks. We've got some pretty major partners involved with that. So for us, you know, we keep an eye on the competitors. We keep an eye on the independents, as we call them. But it's all about just keeping the eye on our prize. Would we love to be number one? Absolutely. But our main competitor, the Pickler guys, with George and Austin, you know, they had a significant head start. They run a good company. They have great locations, and it's really great to be competitive with them. So I think it's going to continue to grow. But I do think that sometime in the future, there has to be some sort of reset, because so many people rush to market so quickly, and some of the models aren't going to work. So when that time comes, we feel like we're going to be fully prepared for it. We're completely confident in our model. We're not changing it. We're confident in our partners, Court Reserve, Pickleball Central, Swish, you know, a whole list of people that we work with. So it's going to be an interesting ride the next couple of years for sure, but it can't keep going the way it's going. You know, we used to boldly report on how many units that we've sold that are under development. We don't talk about that anymore, because now it's all about getting the ones open that we've got in the process. And that's the most important thing at this point.
Well, and honestly, that's the most important thing. I think any of us that are in the business of analyzing what's going on in pickleball is what could be is not the issue. It's what is and what can be, and how do we make it happen? Because it isn't until these wonderful franchises open that they add inventory to the pickleball space. And that's really what is my critical interest in watching the industry so closely is the fact that facilities is what, and new courts is the critical component to pickleball being able to continue to grow and expand. And on that order, one of the other things that we talked about briefly in the past, and I'd like to see if you've had any new or updated information on that, is anything happening with Dildinkers outside the United States?
Well, that's a good question. We're actually working on a location in China right now. We actually, just before this call, I was looking at the initial floor plan for it. So we're working with somebody in China. We're going to probably do some sorts of regional development agreement. We've come really close to Australia. We've come close to Canada, Dubai, Great Britain. With a lot of the volatility lately in the markets with the tariff war and all this other stuff, it has put a little bit of a slowdown on that, which is understandable. But eventually we will be in foreign markets. It's just a matter of time and finding the right partners. We've had partners that, you know, wanted to do all of Mexico or all of South America. And at the end of the day, we just couldn't confirm whether or not they were just laundering money. So we didn't go with it. It's like, oh, we're not getting involved with all that. No, we're not doing that. So we're very careful and just the way we do business. We're very careful in anything and everything we do.
Well, and I think that's smart. You know, it's interesting. I have been in the sports industry a long time. And one of the things that I've often found is that businesses that spend too much time worrying about their competition, as opposed to managing their own business model as acutely as they possibly can, that sometimes can bite them in the back pretty good. So I love the idea of what you're talking about. I've been in a number of your locations, and I've been in a number of the other franchise organizations. And when they're done right, and you see the vibrance of the membership and the people that are playing in those facilities and the fun that they're having, and how important those locations become very quickly in the marketplace, because that's where people start going to play pickleball. And so I wish you all the luck in the world with that. Well, with that, I want to remind everybody who's watched this so far, if you like what you're seeing and you like the kind of guests that I get on this show, hit the like and subscribe button. take the opportunity to download the Selkirk TV app on your phone. It's an amazing resource with podcasts, with coaching, teaching, training, even a lot of live pickleball broadcast of the pro game. It's a great resource, Selkirk TV. That being said, Mr. Will Richards, I want to thank you so much for joining me and updating us on what we'll talk again next year, and we'll see where 2025 into 2026 goes. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, I'll see you at some of the conferences coming up. So take care.
Yes, sir.